This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Tank Sinatra.
And I'm Investigator Slater.
And together we co-host a podcast called Psychopedia, which is a true crime podcast infused with comedy, making it a crimedy. Each week, Investigator Slater brings us a wild and thoroughly researched true crime case. I'm here to digest it all and react just like you probably are right there on the other side of the microphone.
Somehow, I've got to present each case with the detail and respect it deserves, while also cracking up at Tank's perfectly timed humor and thought-provoking questions.
Listen to and follow Psychopedia on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is currently 6:15 on this chilly Thursday morning. I got confused. Yeah, I'm 6 days away from Christmas here. About, if you look at the temperatures throughout the area and average, and first of all, thankfully, no fog. That's the main thing, right? No fog. But if you look at the temperatures and average them around the area in the mid-50s, going up to 66 today, 64 tomorrow, 53 on Saturday, which is nice and holiday-ish, right? 57 on Sunday, but then 65 on Monday, 70 degrees on Tuesday, which is Christmas Eve, if my calendar doesn't deceive me, and then a 65% chance for showers, highs of 68 on Wednesday. So all in all, could have been better, but get together with your friends and your family, and everything will be all right. Forget the weather. Ramon Antonio Vargas joins us now, editor and publisher and reporter at The Guardian. And Ramon, again, I can't thank you enough for the work you do and all of the investigative reporters in Louisiana. And look, I'm not trying to relive anybody's pain or sensationalize anything here, but I think this Lawrence Hecker thing is a classic case study of everything that's wrong with the Archdiocese and the way that they handled this whole thing. And I think what yesterday proved, following your tweets as you were in the courtroom, was that these people, specifically Hecker in this case, hurt a lot of children, and they are still paying for that. The people are paying in terms of pain until this day, and the Archdiocese is yet to pay for it. But with that all said, good morning, Ramon. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Talk about
a very difficult day.
Yeah, I'm just going to turn it over to you, sir, and you can tell us all about it.
Yeah, yesterday was, I think, a day that a lot of people who Lawrence Hecker harmed or had harmed, it was the day that they were waiting for. And yesterday was the time that I guess it was a former student at St. John Vianney High School who pressed the who pursued the criminal case against him that resulted in him pleading guilty to child rape. Yesterday was his chance, first time that we heard him speak publicly. You know, I'd read details of his abuse as laid out by prosecutors and court filings, but yesterday was the first time I saw him get on the witness stand and direct himself to Lawrence Hecker. It was very impressive. Didn't prepare anything. Was guided through by a prosecutor, but I think that the way that he described that, you know, the lifelong effects really of kind of what he went through, which is, you know, he was assaulted at a church next to a school by Hecker, who then when he went to tell, you know, his principal. Told him that that he would be expelled if he didn't get you know, help for fantasy stories and angry issues. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the implication there being that he, you know, they don't believe you, or, you know, if they did believe him, then we're gonna try to discredit you. And then really, I mean, I think that the thing that stuck out to me was, you know, Lawrence Hecker raped me, and my whole aspect of church changed, is what he said yesterday. And he says, I didn't trust anybody. I have zero friends. I pushed everyone away. And he described that even as he grew up, after he met his wife, after they had children, how even his relationships with them, he could never really kind of fully give himself over. This was something that I didn't really put in the story, but you know, I'll share with y'all. I know that one of the other things said is just as when he's doing something as simple as kind of like, you know, putting on underwear in a certain way, like he'll think of the assault even to this day, right?
And it happened and when, Ramon?
Point, that was in 1975. Excuse me?
The assault happened in 1975, and still to this day, it haunts him.
It does haunt him, and I'm just the idea of like when you're doing something as simple as just getting dressed, right? As like mundane as getting dressed, and how it still takes him back, you know, to that moment. You know, it was difficult to. I think that one of the harder the sights that was harder to stomach. Just you know, Lawrence Eckert didn't, you know, had the opportunity to apologize. At the same time, do I think that people would have accepted that apology? Do I think it would have been enough? No. Do I think that, you know, he certainly had the opportunity to at least kind of remove that talking point afterward? He did, and he chose not to do it. But there was a question at the news conference afterward. Oh, well, he's 93, and he seems to be getting worse every time we see him. Like, is he, did he follow, you know, did he understand what happened today? And was he listening? And I think he was. I mean, I think it was apparent that he was. He was sobbing and trembling and groaning at times that seemed to make sense. The more difficult times that
was
kind of the moments that were most, yes, Hecker, the more the moments that were kind of most difficult to just watch from the courtroom gallery. You'd look over at the defense table and he was having appropriate reactions to that. So yesterday was difficult for it seemed like it was difficult for him to hear like the things that he had done, which is obviously the least that most people, you know, would expect him to have to endure. And so, yeah, obviously it was very difficult. And I think that there was the takeaway was just the bravery that I mean, first the victim that I've described and the survivor that I've described, but then two others who also were ready to testify, who also spoke about, you know, the lifelong effects of their abuse at the hands of Hecker. I think everyone was, there was nothing you could really do other than to just admire like the bravery that it took to do that.
Let me take a break here, Ramon, and we'll pick it up when we come back. One thing that stood out to me in your story was that the judge was weeping out of sympathy for the abuse survivors. And these judges have heard a lot throughout their careers. The other thing is that having grown up here, I know that St. John Vianney, which is subsequently closed down, that was where kids went if they wanted to be priests. That's where young men went if they wanted to be priests. And also the details of how this actual rape and happened, you know, I didn't realize before that Hecker showed up unannounced in a weight room where the victim was working out, put a child in a wrestling style headlock, rendered him unconscious and raped him. And that's just beyond reprehensible. And the other thing that I can't get out of my mind is that these are just a few victims of one person, and we can talk about the magnitude as it relates to the archdiocese and really nationwide of how many victims there are out there, how many pedophile priests there are out there, not maybe perhaps currently, I don't know what's going on now, but just the systemic failure to protect kids. 6:22, more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 6:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A couple of minutes left with Ramon Antonio Vargas, who was in the courtroom. And Ramon, it had to be a tough day for you as well. He's the editor and a reporter at The Guardian. It's the sentencing of Lawrence Hecker. He got sentenced to life in prison. What happens now, Ramon, with him? Do you know?
One of the questions that we were trying to figure out is exactly where does he serve out the punishment, right? I think repeatedly on the program, we've mentioned that he's been at a long-term care facility inside of West Jefferson Medical Center under armed guard. Does he stay there? Does he go to, you know, yesterday Jason Williams expressed, you know, in some of the sound bites that he deserves to be in Angola. He's going to ask for him to be in Angola. Is that, you know, does he go there? Does he go to another one of the prisons that maybe is better facilitated for a 93-year-old with some of the, you know, some of the dementia issues that he's, you know, on the record to have? That remains to be seen. What I think is I hope is not lost in the moment, depending on where he ends up, is just, I think at some point, probably 5-6 years ago, right, it went from like, there's no way that this, it seemed like it would be difficult that they would ever do anything against him. Did did he kind of like beat out the clock? I know he repeatedly expressed some of our earlier reporting, as we discussed, you know, like the depositions and the confession that the church tried to hide, and what she basically admitted to being a serial child molester. You know, the idea of in his files, right? The idea that he's like, I tried to beat the system. He was hoping that he could beat the system. I mean, he didn't, right? He will, as my colleague David Hammer said on his on the special that they WWL aired earlier in December, is that, I mean, he will die a convicted child rapist, and he will primarily be remembered for that and not for, you know, the clerical career that he had here in the city.
Let me wrap it up with this. We only have 2 minutes, less than a minute, but Dave Cohen, I might run a minute long here. In civil litigation stemming from his abuse of another victim, Hecker gave a private deposition in which he elaborated on how his church superiors shielded him from being exposed and actually allowed him to be in a position where he could prey on other children. And I guess the thing I would leave with today, Ramona, or wrap up with is, this is one priest. This is one accused pedophile, one convicted pedophile priest, admitted pedophile priest, among God knows how many. And these are, I don't know how many victims yesterday testified, among God knows how many victims. How does this move forward? Where does this go from here?
So there's a state police investigation that this case sort of spurred on. And obviously it's broader. I know that investigation is ongoing. Yesterday we heard the district attorney say that, you know, Hecker's enablers, and they go from middle managers to the very top, right? And not necessarily the one, including the one currently in place, but, you know, his three predecessors have all been under investigation as to whether they're, you know, what actions they took, what they knew, when they knew it, what did they do about it, and does that amount to something that broke the law, and I think the question becomes, and this is what he said, that sometimes your hands can be tied as far as it comes to filing deadlines, statutes of limitation. Certainly, I think yesterday the DA Williams like summed it up when he said that, you know, they, something like what Lawrence Hecker was charged with, right, raping a child, there is no statute of limitation to that. Failing to adequately report him before that, sometimes it can have a statute of limitation. It just remains to be seen. I know that investigation is ongoing. I know, I think that the people in charge of the investigation have shown that if there is a crime that is prosecutable, they have the wherewithal to pursue it. But it just remains to be seen kind of what they find, and if what they find, they found it in time to be able to do something about it.
Ramon, I just got to ask you, Dave, I'm sorry we're late. We're a minute later, Dave Cohen. But you know, you're a reporter. You've been following this. Did it at any point, just the gravity of this whole thing just hit you when you realized the magnitude of how many people were involved in this and this being the case study of it?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's hit me repeatedly. I think yesterday was like a new experience, as far as, I think, when I was trying to go to sleep and I didn't sleep at all. You know, realizing, you know, just the images of what happened that day, but then just realizing the years long process. And it's like I think that, like, what I come away with is what everybody was saying, is that it was a historic moment. I think ultimately for the abuse survivors community, yesterday was momentous, in that, you know, it was a life sentence. And I think a lot of themselves see themselves represented. No, my abuser couldn't be here because they passed away or because they beat the system. But feeling something, like feeling a stake in the events of yesterday. But at the same time, I think that, like, it becomes pretty quickly daunting when you realize, like, how many people did enable him and how many people did not get held accountable for doing that at this point.
Thank you.
Yeah, it gets daunting. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Sorry, I really do. Dave Cohen, I'm sorry we're late. Here's WWL First News. 13 till 7, a little bit late. Quickly to Mike Strain, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Happy holidays, Mike. Merry Christmas to you. How you doing?
Man, I am doing great. I got home from Cuba on Friday, and I walk in my office, and I said, Mr. Brainerd, what day is it? He said, well, it's Friday. I said, yeah, Friday the what? The 13th. I said, of what? December. I said, oh, my goodness. How did it become the 13th of December? I am so excited, one, to be home, because, as you know, I was in England, traveling throughout England with the British government, and then we were just in Cuba on trade missions. It's so good to be back in the United States and right here for Christmas. I'm so excited. This, you know, my favorite time of the year. And as I've been traveling, I was in Lake Charles at an export facility yesterday. Everybody is cooking up a storm. And Uncle Larry cooked for me 2 days ago, Larry Roussel, and we were down for a soil and water meeting. You know, and Uncle Larry always thinks I'm too skinny, and as you know, I'm not. But he had two different types of gumbo, a beautiful Louisiana, magnificent seafood gumbo and a chicken gumbo and Louisiana rice and all the fixings. Oh, my goodness. And I tell you what, that seafood gumbo, and I guess I've just been wanting some so bad, but it had the shrimp. It had, you know, the crabs in it. You know, had just a little bit of sausage in it and over Louisiana rice. And I can tell you, it's good to be in Louisiana.
It is. Mike, let me tell you about it. Good to be in Louisiana. And I know you didn't come on and talk about this, but I had to take a trip to North Louisiana to Ruston over the weekend. And you'd miss the story, but Google Maps sent me through Arkansas. And when I saw that sign going from New Orleans to Ruston, when I saw the sign, welcome to Arkansas, I was flipping out. I don't mind telling you.
You were going to Ruston?
Yeah.
Ruston and you ended up in Arkansas?
Yeah. I was not happy. Believe me, I was not happy at all. But the North Louisiana is some very beautiful country, man. And for people that I'm not trying to be a cheerleader for Louisiana or anything, but it's a beautiful area, man. And rivals in a lot of ways, the Ruston area and those kind of places, Tennessee. Talk about that, if you will, for people that don't go up north.
It is magnificent. You know, in this state, there's so much diversity in our lands. And really, when you fly, if you fly in little bitty airplanes like I do, you can actually see the lines across the state where things change. The soil changes, the topography changes, the crops change. And you get up to Ruston, you know, it's cattle, it is poultry, it's trees, you know, you got rolling hills, and it's just beautiful there. And, you know, some of the finest, friendliest people you ever did see. We normally get up to Ruston and all through Marouge, and we have big pea cookings up there. And so where we gather all the people up and you start off with some fresh, you know, purple hull peas, and, of course, you add all the finest ingredients like pork and chicken, and you have that with fresh tomatoes and fresh onions and fresh cornbread. And of course, and big gatherings, you know, as, you know, we think about big crawfish boils here, we have pea cookings. And it's just so much fun and hardworking people. And, you know, if you look at the 5th Congressional District, Ms. Julia Letlow's district, that is the largest row crop district, farming district in America. The largest row crop farming district in America. And agriculture, let me tell you something, trees, chickens, and crops, that is the total focus and a great deal of that. Now we're getting some industry up in that area, and so we're very excited about that. And if down here, you know, if you're in sugarcane land, you're in cane land, you know, but the topography is very different, but the people are wonderful, hardworking, and it's just, yeah, it's beautiful there. And I tell you, if you drove through, if you get lost and go through the Castache Forest, you know, and 10%, it's huge. The Castache is huge. You know, it's about 10% of the timber owned in Louisiana is by the federal government in the Castache National Forest. And it is, you know, very, very, very well managed. We work with them. You know, we've signed partnership agreements called MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding, where we work with them. And so the amount of, you know, you think about the large landholders in Louisiana, the Castache is larger than that. And so it's well preserved. And everyone needs to drive there and take the road less traveled. Get off.
That's what I did. Unfortunately, I wound up in Arkansas. I didn't want to go that less traveled, but I did. But it was just beautiful country, Mike. It surprised me.
It's beautiful. It really is, and I'm blessed because I get to travel and work with people all through that part of the world.
I was thinking about you, as a matter of fact, as I was driving, thinking this is what Mike's talking about because he always gets to see this. Let's talk about on a not as happy note, flesh eating maggots and cattle imports. What's going on there?
Yes, and so, you know, back in the 60s, 1969 specifically, we eradicated what's called the New World screwworm, which is a, quote, a maggot that is laid by flies. And what makes this so worrisome is that normally when you get, quote, you know, and again, the screwworms, which is, you have to think of maggots. It's on dead tissue. It's on a wound, something that's injured. But the thing about this particular bug, it will attack live, normal, healthy flesh. Now, it was eradicated and in 1969 from commercial livestock in the United States by a novel technique where they released sterilized male flies which would then mate with the females, and they wouldn't reproduce, and the population was eradicated. There was a small case down in lower Florida a couple of years ago. They found some in deer. Not exactly sure how those flies got to that part of Florida, but that was eradicated. Now, since then, we had pushed it down below the Panama Canal, and the disease was in South America, but now it's been found in Mexico. And we're not sure how prevalent it is in Mexico. So the federal government has temporarily halted all importation of Mexican livestock, that's cattle, horses, et cetera, from Mexico into the United States. And we are watching very carefully. Our accredited veterinarians, which I am one on a personal basis, which means in addition to having a being a licensed veterinarian, I'm a contract and have extra training with the USDA to monitor. So we're going to get ahead of this. We're going to monitor for this. There's going to be a lot more inspections. But for now, there will be no importation of any live livestock, and that's horses and cattle, et cetera, from Mexico till we get a handle on this.
Thank you, Mike Strain. Appreciate you as always. Look, have a Merry Christmas, man. I hope you all enjoy it, and we'll talk to you again, I think, next Thursday maybe, hopefully.
Next Thursday, and look, you got to gain a pound between now and Thursday, or you're not holding up your end.
I'm going to do it for you. I'm going to do it for you, Mike. I'm going to do it for you.
I know you are.
Ha. Thank you, sir.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too. 6:54, 6 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Chilly day compared to what we've been having, and it's going to get a little cooler as we move on and matriculate our way toward Christmas, which is nice. Unfortunately, come Christmas is going to warm up. It's 56 degrees right now, mostly cloudy if you average the temperatures in the area. Highs of 66 today. Supposed to clear out later on, 64 tomorrow, 53 for a high on Saturday, 57 on Sunday. So get us all in a Christmas mood, but then, unfortunately, it warms toward the big day itself. 66 on Monday, a 50% chance for showers Tuesday, highs of 70, and then a lingering chance for showers about 70% on Christmas Day with highs of 68. But get together with friends and family, and the rest of it will work itself out. Libby Saunier joins us right now, our friend, executive director of the Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, to talk about a new study about 27% of third graders in Louisiana scoring below level, and how important it is that kids read at grade level and early education. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. And you?
Fine. Are you ready for Christmas?
We're getting there.
How about the shopping? Percentage of shopping completed. Where are you?
Probably about 40%.
Okay. Will you promise me you won't spend more than $100 on me?
I'll promise you that.
I have your word?
You have my word.
Okay, good. I appreciate it. Let's get serious now and talk about this new, results of a reading test that was given this fall. Tell me about how they go about determining 27% of third graders score well below. 19% scored below goals set by the state when it comes to reading. Who are we talking about here, Libby?
They are looking at reading assessments of those third graders in the school district. So that's how they measured that. About 4 or 5 years ago, they started a literacy commission at the Department of Education. Back when it started, I was on it. And they've really spent, they meaning the Louisiana Department of Education, have really spent a lot of time and effort thinking strategically about how they do improve those third grade reading scores so that children, you know, can thrive. And because you learn to read from kindergarten to third grade, and then you read to learn after that. So it's increasingly important that these scores are getting better, which they are, but it's still, you know, worrisome that we have 27% of children in third grade reading below benchmark.
I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but when it comes to determining reading at level, is it about speed? Is it about comprehension? What does that look like, Libby?
It's about both of those things. It's about fluency, how fluent you can read, recognition of words, how you're doing phonics, those types of things. And then are you able to comprehend what you're reading? Because reading without comprehension means that you're not going to be able to read to learn.
And if you're not comprehending it, how do you even know you're reading it? I'm not trying to get to
you're just reading words on the page. I mean, you're able to kind of like figure out what the words are. But if you don't have good fluency, which means reading with more and more ease, then you can't really comprehend what a story is, what the sentence is meaning as you're reading it.
I know a little about a lot of different things, and that's only because I read a lot as a young guy. And you and I may have had this discussion before, but man, I would read this and they'd make a reference to that. I didn't know what it was, so I'd go and look it up, and then I'd read something else and make a reference to that, and I didn't know what it was. I'd look that up. So you learn as you read. That's why it is so important that these young people read, correct?
Absolutely. And that doesn't just start in third grade. It really starts all the way from the time a mom is pregnant, because baby's here at 20 weeks gestation. And so we know that we've got to make sure that in those early birth to 5 years before children get to kindergarten, that they're having access to rich literacy and learning environments with a lot of language, so that when they enter into kindergarten, they're ready to learn. But another statistic in our state is that 70% of our kindergartners are entering into kindergarten already behind. And so if we're thinking about those third grade reading scores, we know we have to back it up, and we have to ensure that children have access to quality early childhood education so that they can enter into kindergarten ready to learn. And what that looks like is, you know, differentiating between sounds. What's the difference between a P and a B and a D? If you don't hear those subtleties of speech, when it's time to learn how to read and put sound symbol relationship, it's hard. And then you get into the comprehension and fluency issues as the children age.
I'm passionate about this because, again, as I said, I know how important reading was to me. And I would think now, you know, back in the day, Libby, I didn't have to go to parchment or anything. It wasn't that bad. But you did have to go through some steps to do some research to figure out what did this mean and what did that reference mean. Now, man, I would think a kid reading would be able to just access whatever as quickly as they could, either through AI or Google or whatever, to find not just an example, but almost like a tree of things to learn from one reference.
Absolutely. The way we can consume knowledge these days is a far cry from when both you and I were young, where you just didn't have internet. You went to the encyclopedia and that's what you had. And so now you can just get information everywhere, but how you really do consume that information is by reading and going down these little rabbit holes related to references. Again, if you've got to have that early childhood education piece so that we have the sound symbol relationship, we have the nuance of sound so that we can get to phonics, and phonics helps with fluency that leads to comprehension. And I really do want to commend the Louisiana Department of Education, because Dr. Kate Brumley has had a targeted work related to this early literacy piece starting in kindergarten. And we continue to herald that decision and say it, but it also begins with making sure that children birth to five have early childhood experiences that lead to them being, you know, successful in school and in life.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. So is this 27%? Is it good news? Is it bad news? Does it indicate progress? Step forward, step back, no change. And then how do you fix it? We're talking to Libby Soni about the importance of early childhood education, specifically when it comes to reading. She's the executive director of the Louisiana Policy Institute. I always like to learn a new phrase, at least one every day. And Libby, you just taught me one. Reference rabbit holes. I love that, because you see something, you go to look it up, and then you go down the hole and you learn more things before you realize you're learning them. 7:21 traffic now, WWL. 27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Libby Sonier, executive director of Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about 27% of third graders in Louisiana scoring far below the reading level. So where does that fit in context, Libby? Is it a step back, step forward, no change? And how do we move the kids forward?
Well, it's a step forward. And part of it, too, is that the state, you know, has really made a concerted effort in early literacy and making sure that children have these literacy skills to be successful, you know, for the last several years. And so they are really doing a lot. The Department of Education is doing a lot of work around educating teachers on the science of reading, which we know has beneficial effects for them to understand how young children learn how to read and then read to learn. And they're doing that in a systematic way. And And it's really, it's starting to pay off. And so, you know, a 2% gain is much better than having more losses. And so I think the thing to keep in mind is we're not where we want to be, but that doesn't happen overnight. And so that concerted effort for K through third grade, and then the increased access to quality early childhood education will continue to be helpful. It'll be particularly important as we go into the new legislative season that we don't see any reductions in early childhood education for those birth to five-year-olds. And then we continue to see progress made on training teachers in the science of reading to be supportive of how young children learn how to read.
Yeah, a lot of people make New Year's resolutions, and hopefully parents will be making them about their kids and, right, wanting to make their kids' lives better. What can parents do to improve these reading scores, and what age group are we talking about? And tell me what that looks like. What a mom or dad can do with their kids to help out? Because you can't, I don't care if it's the most private school in the world, most exclusive school, unless it's a boarding school, it's not turnkey. The parents have to be involved, right? So what can they do,
Absolutely.
Libby?
So from the time a little one is born, parents need to ensure that they are reading and reading and reading and singing and talking. That's critically important in those early years. We know that 90% of brain development happens by the age of four. And so you really got to invest in reading and singing and talking and exploring language with young children. And then as they age, you want to continue to do those same things. You want to make sure that you're opening up potential opportunities to accidentally learn something through reading to a child and being exploring and having opportunities to explore the world around them. And even for parents that are really struggling financially, read and talk and sing to your child. Those early years pay off in dividends. And, you know, parents oftentimes can't give what they don't have because they could be struggling, but we can always make a little bit of time to read. And I think that is an important thing to also mention is that the state has expanded the Dolly Parton's Imagination Library so that children have access to books and get a book a month for their first few years of life so that parents have a library at home. And those kind of opportunities are critically important to how young children acquire language and then how they learn how to read.
Real quick, Libby, how do parents access that Dolly Parton? What is it?
Dolly Parton Library, uh-huh. And so it's in the greater New Orleans area. Our wonderful United Way of Southeast Louisiana is the one who operates it. So you can go on their website and look at that in the greater New Orleans area. It's just wonderful because it really does give families access to books that they may not normally have.
It's not only wonderful, it's everything. And I appreciate your efforts, Libby. I really do. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you, okay?
Merry Christmas to you, too. Thank you so much.
You bet. Libby Sonnier, Executive Director, Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. It is everything when it comes to early childhood education, and it reaps benefits or the opposite of that when we move forward if you don't get it done. Michael Glasser joins. We come back. President of PANO. We'll talk about the consent decree and more right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to our news director, Dave Cohen. All right, 7:46 now, 14 till 8 on this Thursday morning, 6 days till Christmas. Captain Michael Glasser joins us now, our friend, president of PANO. How you doing, Captain?
Good morning, Tommy.
I always get it confused. How many years on the job now?
I'm in year 48.
Man, I would like to sit down with you one day. Huh? That's okay? Everything's all right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I would like to sit down and pick your brain one day and just hear some stories about 48 years on a job as an officer and rising up to the rank of captain. Let's talk about the consent decree. And I don't know what it looks like from your standpoint, from the officer's standpoint, and what's going to really change when it goes away. Tell me about that, if you will.
Well, a lot of people have misconceptions about what this means. A lot of people don't even understand what a consent decree is, other than the fact they hear it all the time, but they really don't know what it is. The bottom line is this, Tommy. This means we're going to be entering what's called a sustainment period. And all that means is the federal oversight that we have is going to be significantly reduced. It does not change what we do. It does not change the rules we follow. The consent decree and all the paragraphs in it are now embedded in our regulations and in our rules. That's what we do. That's not going to change. The only thing that changes is the oversight. The best way to explain that is this. I'll use this analogy. You know, you have a vehicle, you have a car. Mm-hmm. You check the tire pressure periodically. You check the oil. You check the transmission fluid. You check the washer fluid. You check the lights.
I didn't know you were a canine unit.
Power steering fluid. Sir?
Are you a canine unit?
No.
Oh, I didn't know. That's no worries. No, no, we're anyway, very dog friendly here, Captain. We're very dog friendly. I just didn't know. Go ahead.
No, thank you. Anyway, you know, you check all those things, but you don't check it every time you get in the car. You check it periodically. You check it if something poses a problem. You check it if something is very obvious, the tires are low. But you don't check it every single time you get in the car and every time you get out of the car. Well, that's what the consent decree is like with us. We have so much oversight that there's so many things we have to check constantly and go over constantly that we don't have the ability to function. It's just labor-intensive to get that accomplished. And that's one of the things that's been problematic with the consent decree is that it is so labor intensive for all the oversight that we have that we can't function. What the sustainment period means is simply this. We're going to turn around and have it checked periodically. We'll have it checked randomly. And obviously, if a problem shows up, we're going to fix that. So that means we basically sustain ourselves. But the rules and regulations of the consent decree are now embedded in our department regulations. Nothing's going to change. And the second thing to remember is that we've been under a consent decree for 12 years. We had a high turnover rate on this police department. That means that the overwhelming majority of this department has never functioned in a department that didn't have a consent decree and the rules that we now follow. So it's a small percentage of the department left that actually knows how it quote-unquote used to be, mm-hmm. because the department has basically a new department. So nobody's really functioned, especially the guys on the street, the younger fellas that are on the street and gals that are on the street. They've never functioned any other different way. And they're not going to, because it's in our rules now, and that's the way we operate.
That could be the most perceptive or the most interesting perception of this consent decree that I've heard, Captain, and that is that there's been such turnover in the department. Few officers remember, other than people like yourself, how it, quote, used to be. And moving forward, it's not as though, okay, the consent decree goes away. The operation of the consent decree goes away, but the operation of the department does not. Accurate?
It's just the oversight that goes away.
Right, that's what I meant. The maintenance of the decree itself.
The best analogy I can give you is what I gave you. You don't have to go around and check your tire pressure every single time you get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You can check it periodically. You can put an eye on it, make sure your tires don't look low, but you don't have to put a gauge on it every single time you get in the car.
But to carry the metaphor,
another hour to every trip you take.
Right, to carry the metaphor forward, the new pressure that has been set at 35 as opposed to 32 remains the new pressure.
That's it. That's all we do. And instead of checking it every 5 minutes, we just check it periodically, or if there, you know, a problem pops up and we see a problem, we do that. We check it randomly, we check it periodically, and if a problem pops up, but we don't have to check it every single day, every single time, because that's labor intensive, and as you know, we're labor challenged.
Yeah, I don't
want to. We're at 800, maybe 850 cops now that are actually on the street. We should have double that. So we're working hard to do all these things, and that's it's going to be good for that to unleash that burden for a while.
Let's pick it up there. We come back. I just got to ask you real quick. What kind of dog? Sound like a German Shepherd, was it?
It is a German Shepherd. Yeah,
I knew it. I grew up with him. I figured that. All right, what's the dog's name?
Zeke.
Zeke, good name. All right, 7:51, more with Captain Michael Glasser. We come back 9 till 8. 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 58, 2 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Captain Michael Glasser, president of Pano, he along with Zeke, his trusty German Shepherd. We grew up with those dogs. We grew up with those dogs, Captain. I love German Shepherds, but the hair can be a lot.
Well, mine's all black and he's short hair, so it's not too bad.
There you go. Let's talk about NOPD moving forward and manpower and next year and so forth. How bad is the manpower issue and with the academies and with attrition? Is anything really getting any better? Because it seems like the numbers keep going down. I don't have it in front of me right now. And how does that affect what's – I guess the bottom line is, has anything changed manpower-wise when it comes to actual street operations?
No, it actually hasn't. The good news is it hasn't really gone down, and if it has, maybe by a little, we're kind of breaking even. But, you know, the problem has been, and we've talked about this before, is that when we lose an experienced officer and we hire a new recruit, we don't hire cops. We hire recruits. And it takes them 6 months in the academy, 4 months with field training, before they are, in fact, police officers. And then when they are, they're rookie police officers with no experience. So it takes almost a year for somebody we hire on to become a police officer and a rookie at that. And we're replacing an experienced officer with that. So we're always lagging a year behind in terms of one for one. So you could say, you know, if we lose 100 cops and we hire 100 recruits, we didn't really break even, because those 100 recruits are not going to be on the street while these cops are gone. Mm-hmm. So that's why we shrink. And then, unfortunately, we have a lot of turnover. We have a lot of people who find out the job isn't for them for a variety of reasons. And so we're lucky enough to break even at this point. We're not really shrinking badly, but we're still behind the eight ball on this.
Thank you, Captain. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you. Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. To talk about the holidays. It can be a time of joy, but for a lot of people, it's also a difficult time of year. Dr. B, first of all, Merry Christmas to you and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. I know. I can't believe we're almost at the end of the year.
And I ask everybody this, and I'll ask you to make the same commitment. Please promise me you will not spend more than, say, $500 on me.
I'm going to try my best, Tom.
Do I have your word?
I'm going to try, I tell you.
All right, we're going to talk about some tips for taking care of your emotional well-being during this holiday season. I guess, Doc, we'll start with the basics. What do we talk about when we say emotional well-being?
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's the basis for the way you think, the way you feel. Your emotional well-being really affects how you make decisions and how you connect with other people around you. And what's really critical is it's also a key part of your overall wellness, your health and wellness. And the CDC actually says positive emotional wellness can actually lower the risk of certain diseases or even sicknesses, things like cold and flu and even injuries. So it is really critical.
So there is a linkage there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Emotions are extremely important.
How can the holidays affect our well-being?
Well, it's probably not going to be surprising to anyone, but the American Psychological Association says that almost 90% of adults in the U.S. have increased stress during this time of the year. I'm sure a lot of people are experiencing it right now, and it may be related to trying to host that, you know, perfect dinner party or choosing the perfect gift for somebody. And then, you know, if you have to manage travel this time of year, that's extremely stressful. A lot of people have tight budgets right now, too. And then, of course, there's going to be the family coming to town and spending a lot of time with that family. Dynamics can be variable, and so that can cause a lot of stress for people, too. So it's going to be, you know, specifics are different for everybody, but it's understandable why so many people can feel overwhelmed at this time of year.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, family, I think, thank God for alcohol. I'm just kidding, okay? I'm just playing around. Let's talk about loneliness, seriously.
Yeah, loneliness can really affect your well-being as well, and it's super common, especially in people who maybe live alone, or if you've lost a loved one, and not even necessarily recently. This time of year can actually kind of exacerbate those feelings of loneliness if you lost someone even a few years ago. You know, and you're seeing a lot of other people, you know, traveling around and getting together, and if you can't travel to celebrate with your family, that's going to increase your loneliness as well. And it's hard to deal with any time of the year, but it gets really intense around the holidays because you're seeing so many people getting together and having a great time. So that can really be upsetting to a lot of people.
You know, as you say that, it seems like the Facebook phenomenon where people see things on Facebook all throughout the year and they think that that's real life and that's that everybody else is having stuff that you aren't having. And it seems like that's kind of like the same thing that people go through here, but in a little bit different way with the holidays.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they call it FOMO, fear of missing out, because you're seeing all these people having a great time and you're thinking, why am I not doing that? But it's perfectly normal.
Let's talk about some tips to deal with it.
Yeah, so the biggest tip I give people, and I try to tell myself this all the time, is learn to say no. It's really important. You know, during the holidays, you're going to feel a lot of pressure to accept every invitation, but really there's only 24 hours in a day, and there's no way you can fill all of those obligations, because you've got to have time for yourself to rest, to decompress, and really focus on your own well-being. And so I tell people all the time, kind of pause and think about what your priorities are going to be for this holiday season. And then, you know, use that information to choose which activities you really want to do, what events you're going to attend. But make sure that you've got a plan to help you feel a little less overwhelmed by everything that's going on, and more in control of what can be a very busy schedule this time of year.
Well, that's a key word, control. So that's your first tip. What's tip number two, Doc?
Yeah, you know, the other thing is get creative with gift giving. People can get very stressed out about getting gifts, and there may be a lot of last minute present buying. You know, so sometimes try something a little different. Give somebody something homemade, maybe low cost or no cost, can be a great way to show appreciation for people in your life. And it may be more sentimental. You know, everybody's got pictures on their phone. You know, print one of those out and put it in a frame. That can be a wonderful gift for somebody in your family. And another thing I tell people, and I love these, is actually gift someone an experience, because that may be quality time you can spend together with your loved ones. And, you know, my wife does this for me all the time. She recently did an oyster tour down in Burris, and it was one of the best gifts I had ever gotten, because we got to spend time together, and I learned how to shuck oysters and eat them all.
Those Dr. Hand shucking oysters? Oh, I don't think so.
I wear the gloves.
There you go. You got to wear the gloves. But you know, Doc, along those lines, my kid's fiance made for me a stained glass image of, and you know how you and I share an affection for boxers. Affectation was the word I was thinking of. And of Betsy in stained glass, and it was not just a generic boxer. They actually took the time to take pictures, and they captured her, man, on a little stained glass thing that I hang in the house, and that is of more value to me than a brand new car. I'm not kidding. So there is something to be said for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the presence you're always going to remember. I've got a painting of mine hanging in the hallway.
Yeah, if you send me a picture, I might be able to get you a little stained glass thing made. We'll talk about that later. Let's talk about tip number three when we come back. We're talking to our friend, Dr. Brent Wallace, Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, about the holidays being a time of joy, but it can also be a difficult time of year. He's given us through tips two, one through two already, and we'll talk about tip three when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health, about ways to deal with the stress of the holidays. Couple of tips. Number one, learn to say no. Number two, get creative with gift giving. How about number three, Doc?
Yeah, so don't forget to take a break, you know, from all the chaos when, you know, you're focusing on trying to make your family happy, but don't forget to take care of yourself as well. So if you start feeling overwhelmed, hit pause, you know, maybe sit down and watch a movie this weekend. Maybe you can drink some hot cocoa outside, or just walk around the neighborhood. And if you're still feeling stressed, take some time, you know, deep breathing or meditation, really try to relax a little bit.
Yeah, it's supposed to be fun, right? Maybe we need to remember that. It's supposed to be fun. What else can we do?
Yeah, don't forget to take care of your health as well. You know, things are pretty crazy this time of year, and it's tempting to just say, oh, worry about that next year and set aside all your good habits. But you want to try to maintain your healthy lifestyle that hopefully you've built over the last year. That's going to really improve your emotional state and make it easier to get through the holidays and everything. So try to eat some healthy foods. We know there's going to be a lot of holiday baking and fried turkeys and all of those things, but you know, don't abandon good nutrition altogether. You want to try to find a little space on your plate for fruits and vegetables, and make sure you're drinking enough water as well.
How about some next, another tip?
Ways to support your emotional health? Make sure you try to stick to your sleep schedule. That's really important because you can lose sleep during this time of year, and that's going to stress you out. Try to exercise, too, you know, especially after a big meal. Get up and walk around the neighborhood and enjoy all the holiday decorations and stuff. And then we know there's going to be a lot of Christmas cocktails, but don't overdo the alcohol. You want to be cautious about how much you drink because a lot of alcohol can actually make your stress worse.
Yeah, I was kidding about that earlier, but you do have to do that in moderation. Something else to do, Doc, that you can do to kind of help yourself with the stress of the holidays?
Yeah, you know, this is a great time of year, and really any time is a great time to give back as well. So look for volunteer opportunities. There's a ton of them around this time of year. It may just be something like helping out a local nonprofit or handwriting cards for people in a nursing home. It's a great way to express your gratitude. And if you're feeling lonely, there's going to be other people volunteering. So it may be a great way to meet and connect with those people. You may find out they've got similar interests, and it could be a new friend for life.
Final tips, Doc?
Yeah, I think the other thing to remember, Tommy, this is really important, is don't be afraid to reach out. You know, if you're really feeling stressed, you know, or sad or alone, you want to make sure that you ask for support. And that can be from your loved ones, your family, or even your healthcare provider. You know, don't delay on something like that. And if you think that this is a crisis type situation, if you're really feeling lonely, really sad, don't forget that you can always call or text 988. That's the crisis hotline, and it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you've always got someone you can reach out to if you feel like you need to.
I think part of it, Doc, too, is you got to, you know, temper your expectations, and you got to be realistic, because sometimes you look at Christmas and December and New Year's as this completely different entity, when in fact it's only 30 days away from January 25th, right? Just as March 25th is a month away from April 25th. So
exactly.
It's important.
It's supposed to be a really fun time, and I think people look at it because it's the end of the year. You know, I've got to get everything done, but, you know, time keeps moving. And right. In a couple of weeks, it's going to be January. You'll be starting the new year. Don't get too stressed out or feel like you're missing out on something, like you were saying earlier. It's really important to try to enjoy this time of year, and you know, and if you can, spend it with some people that you really enjoy spending time with.
I enjoy spending time with you. We all do, Doc, and thank you for all the tips that you've given us this year and ways to keep us healthy. I hope you and your family have a very Merry Christmas, very Happy New Year. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by St. Sideline reporter Jeff Nowak to talk about the black and gold. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. You know I'm a fan of yours. You can follow Jeff online at Jeff, well, I say online, on Twitter at, well, X. Well, why don't you tell people how to follow you, Jeff? It might speed the entire thing up.
Yeah, it's on Twitter at Jeff_Nowak, N-O-W-A-K. I also host a podcast with Steve Geller called Inside Black and Gold. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts, and also do it live on YouTube at WWL Sports. Got over 12,000 subscribers there now, so it's been cool to see that whole community grow, and we get a lot of comments in our live mailbags that we do every week, so it's always fun. So definitely check that out.
Y'all do a great job with that. You really do. I wanted to ask you about, I think it's a privilege, and I know it can be a pain in the behind, but man, to be on the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field, December 23rd, I don't know if snow is forecast or not, but you got to be looking forward to that, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be that cold. And when I say that cold, I mean, the way Darren Rizzi put it last week, and I agree with him, it's like if you go up to Green Bay in December, at the end of December, and you get two digits on the temperature, then you're in good shape. And that's what it looks like it's going to be. It's going to be low 20s. But no, you know, the bummer about this game is that it doesn't mean more in the grand scheme of, like, it would be great. It would feel a lot different if you were going up there and you were in the thick of a playoff chase and, you know, the motivation was there and there's a lot more energy. Like when they went up to Cleveland in 22, they were in a similar record scenario, but it felt like they were in the playoff chase. They could win out. They had a chance. This year, it kind of feels like, yeah, you went out, you don't have a chance because the math isn't there. So that's gonna ding it a little bit. But no, anytime you get to go up to Green Bay, Lambeau Field, Monday Night Football, national television, it's going to be a cool experience. I don't think it's going to snow, but there will be snow in Green Bay, so they'll get that kind of, hey, it's Christmas, you know, kind of deal. But, no, it's going to be fun, I think.
So when you say not that cold, you grew up where?
I grew up in Connecticut, so
okay.
I know what it's like to have a cold winter. I don't know what it's like to live in perpetual cold for, like, 6 months of the year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I grew up, but I've been here, down here long enough. I lived in South Carolina for 4 years. I've lived here for 8 years. So that is sufficiently long enough that I am not, like, my blood is thinned. I cannot handle cold. Like, that doesn't help. After a while, it's like, yeah, I'm just like everyone else.
So officially for Green Bay Monday, we're talking about a 50% chance, a 60% chance for snow now, with a high temperature of 34 degrees, so maybe you might see some snow, Jeff.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, like, if it's super cold, it's actually, like, too cold to snow. So we'll see. Yeah, it does look like it's going to maybe have some precipitation, but 29 degrees on the low is pretty, or in that range is, mm-hmm. is a pretty solid, you know, you can't complain too much if that's what you're getting.
Let's talk about... I guess the injury situation first. Alvin Kamara, do we know if he's gone for the year yet or not?
I don't think he's gone for the year. I mean, from a health perspective, I'm sure he'd be able to get back. The question is whether it makes sense to bring him back over the final two games and you're eliminated from the playoffs. The selfish part of me, so he has 950 rushing yards right now. He's never ran for 1,000 yards in his career. Like,
no kidding.
I don't know how much that means to Alvin. As a fan, I think it means something. So I don't want Alvin to get to the end of his career and have that footnote. Oh, he never ran for 1,000 yards. It doesn't really change anything. He's still going to be the greatest Saints running back that ever played. And, you know, he's the franchise rushing leader. It's honestly amazing, and it talks to his level of consistency, that he's the franchise rushing leader without ever running for 1,000 yards. But I'm sure he wants to get there. I would love to see him get one more game, get a shot at it. I'd be surprised if it's this week when you're dealing with an injury and then you're saying, oh, we're going to go up and have you play in below freezing temperatures in a game that, you know, isn't going to change our playoff hopes. I don't know, but I don't think he's done for the year. It doesn't sound like a super significant injury. It's a groin adductor issue. But all the injury questions are going to come down at this point to, is it worth it? And that's what we're going to find out this week. The problem, as we talk today, so they're playing on Monday. The entire weekly schedule is a day behind. Yesterday, they treated like their Monday practice this week, so there was no injury report. Our first injury report of the week is going to come today. They're going to have availability today. So we're going to talk to Darren this afternoon, get a better picture of what we're looking at. Darren, you know, we've kind of gone back to the Sean Payton way of, like, never getting any injury information. DA was always a lot more forthcoming about some of the injury statuses, and he would declare stuff earlier in the week. Darren Rizzi is clearly more on the line of, hey, I prefer the mystery. If I can force my opponent to have to prepare for multiple things because they don't know what to expect from an injury perspective and an availability perspective, that's an advantage for me. So I don't know if we'll get a ton of information on Derek Carr or Alvin Kamara, but we'll have to wait and see.
I don't see the need to let anybody know before you need to know, right? I mean, why would you want to give anybody an advantage? Let me take a quick break. We'll talk about quarterbacks and more when we return. Jeff Nowak, our guest, WWL Saints sideline reporter, got his long drawers packed. He's ready to go. Traffic now, WWL. Never enough time, 8:59, a minute left with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, what's going to happen at quarterback on Sunday? Monday night.
We'll have to wait and see. I mean, it's still going to be a question of whether Derek Carr plays. I'd be surprised. It's hard to see a scenario where you don't go back to Spencer Rattler. The one thing I don't want to do is start Spencer and have to bench him because it's going so poorly. If the Saints decide to go with Spencer Rattler, I need the leash to be long. So that's a decision they have to make. Because if you're going to play Spencer, you're going to have to let him play through struggles. Because you already benched him once this year. You don't want to do it again. So I think that's the question you want to answer.
And you know what? If you do that and it doesn't work, then I think you got to do the same thing with Jake Haener the next week. Thoughts?
It's tough. Yeah, that's the awkward scenario they find themselves in. So we'll have to wait and see how they handle it.
Man, look, safe travels to you. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year for everything you do for us. We appreciate it. God bless you, Jeff Nowak. And go Saints. When we come back, we're going to talk about these drone sightings in the Northeast. Could be interesting. Appreciate it. Let's talk about these drone sightings in the Northeast and try to separate fact from fiction and what's going on, because I think you got a couple of things going on. You got the drone sightings, you got social media. Some of it's getting lost with the holidays, so people have just like a half an eye on it, and as a result, sometimes that can lead to some misconception and misperception. So with that all said, let's welcome in Will Austin, the Warren Community College president and the college's chief drone pilot. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you today?
I am okay. Thank you for taking the time, because this really did kind of capture my attention, because I think it speaks to so many things, one of which is we don't know what we don't know. Another thing is we like to make up things when we don't know it. Let's talk about how this whole thing began for people that know of it but don't really know about it.
Yeah, ironically, about a month ago, there were a couple of lights in the sky that someone identified as a drone, and a local politician of mine sent it to me, and I said, could be a drone, it could be three drones, it could be a drone and two planes. I said that the picture's so, it's so poorly taken at night that I can't really tell. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'll send some students over in those areas. They're always looking for something interesting in the drone area. And we came back and found basically that there were some recreational hobby drones. And then the story kind of grew, ended up in USA Today, ended up on Fox News, a number of other places, MSNBC. Now it's everywhere, of course. And what we've done is so many people have come in here to have us look at the video, the pictures, and we've been able to identify the vast majority of them as airplanes. A lot of them were taken near the airport. Some of the video, actually, you could see the airplane landing at the airport, and I was taken aback by that because I was looking at something that's obviously not a drone to most people, but that person, to them, it was a drone.
But, Professor, I hate to tell you this, but the society we're living in now, rather than say, oh, I was mistaken, it was a drone, there is a percentage of the population that would morph that into, now they're finding a way to turn drones into aircraft.
Well, drones are aircraft. That's what
what I meant. Turning it into a commercial plane is what I meant to say. I shouldn't have said that.
Sorry
to
about
a professor
that.
Of all people.
I'm the laid back kind. So, okay. I think what you're seeing is then as this kind of went and the media attention went, and people in Louisiana and New Orleans have drones as well. People started going out, putting their drones up at first to see if they could find these mystery drones that people said were bus size, which really don't exist at this point unless the military's flying them around or on some test runs that everybody would know. So they're not just, you're not seeing these kinds of aircraft flying around without permission from the federal government. So that caused people to see actual drones and then think that the other ones must exist because they're not familiar with drones. And then now I think what we're seeing and the things that are coming into me now are more the teenagers have figured out that this is a lot of fun. So they're going out on the nice nights and helping out a lot for people to see drones for the first time. And I think there is that kind of thing as the constituents call the local politicians. They go out and there's some misidentification by them. And I always watch Louisiana and New Jersey very closely because I think there is a race between us to see who can elect the most interesting politicians to office. But I think we usually lead, but you guys come on strong once in a while.
It's pretty tight. Pretty tight. I don't know who's going to cover the spread on that one. I should mention that Warren Community College is in Washington Township, New Jersey. And have you seen any of these purported drones yourself, Professor, or is that in your area of New Jersey? Of course, New Jersey, a big state.
Yeah, we're right next to where they were originally spotted. So we're right next to the county where they were. So I've gone out at night. I can't even remember how many times. And I've gone out with people, and I've spotted small drones myself. Nothing over 10 pounds has been identified at this point by anyone that I'm aware of. I've seen them flying around. I've stood with people who identified planes in the sky, but to them they saw a drone. And I think that's what starts to happen at a certain point. New technology comes on board, and people start to see drones. I often say right now it's in New Jersey. It's kind of like if you remember that old saying, to a hammer, all the world's a nail, because we try to hammer in screws.
Right.
Well, right now in New Jersey, any light in the sky is a drone. And that's what's happening, because people are expecting to see drones. They think there must be all these drones. They trust, you know, their neighbors that they saw drones. And the reality is the people who thought they saw drones will always think they saw drones. Any kind, we see this with new technology. We can go back to the nuclear age, 1947, there's the flying saucer craze. 57, there's the Sputnik. They were spying on us, you know, from satellites when the first satellite went up. And now you're seeing drones for the first time in mass. And people, you know, it's a robotic revolution, and people are going to be what people do when they don't understand something. So we need to better communicate. That's why we started our program here at the college, because we kind of saw this coming. Not quite to this level. I can't say I predicted that. But I expected people to be very anxious about these drones flying around them.
Is there anything such as an average-sized drone? Or take me through drones, because I bought my kid one. Go ahead.
2.3 pounds is what the vast majority of them are going to be. They're going to be the DJI Mavics. You might have some old Phantoms still flying. You might have a Skydio, which again is going to be about 2 pounds. The vast majority of these are 2 pound pieces of flying plastic with a camera and nothing at all to be afraid of. But I will admit, even though I'm in the drone, the sounds are a little annoying, and I know all the manufacturers are trying to make the noise go away. When there's a camera up there, people think it would be an invasion of privacy. I like to remind people that there might be one drone in the sky that sees you, but if you walk your dog around your neighborhood in New Jersey, you're probably on 40 Ring cameras. I'm not sure how much privacy we have anymore.
That's an excellent point, but it's airborne, so all of a sudden, look out, right?
well, you know, we've been that way towards anything space and aviation for a long time.
Let's talk about the prevalence of drones, or the evolution, maybe, if we will, because now that we've—and look, I'm going to open the audience, the Oquinard Jeweler Talking text line here to the audience for people that have any questions about the drones in New Jersey, 504-260-1870. Why do you think a text comes in? Why does the professor think that it's only in that area of the United States? I think I have an answer, but you go ahead first, Professor.
Well, I think it's been other places. This has happened in Colorado a couple of years back. But when New Jersey especially this part of New Jersey, is a major suburb like Connecticut to New York City. Mm-hmm. And New York City is where the media capital of the United States is. So a lot of people in the media live in New Jersey. So they're hearing from their neighbors, too. So I think, you know, whenever anything happens in the New York City area, it takes on a kind of larger significance than other parts of our country, because it's real easy to drive out here from the studios in New York. It's a little harder to get to Colorado or New Orleans from here. So I think that's why you're seeing it blow up so much in this region. But I suspect there's all over the country there are drones, so probably about 20,000 on average in every state.
It would seem to me my answer was going to be the same reason there are so many red cars on the road once you get a red car, right?
Yeah, I bought a yellow car once and was shocked how many more there were.
Uh-huh. That's what I think. Let me take a break. I want to talk about drones when we come back, because I got my adult kid one, I think maybe 4 years ago for a present, and it was a small one, and I think the phone, you put your phone on it, that was the camera that was included. For people that are thinking about drones for Christmas gifts, we'll talk about regulations, what they should look for, what they shouldn't, what does or does not have to be registered, how do you get involved with flying a drone, how hard is it? Somebody texted in and said 5% of them can't be identified. I don't know how uncommon that is or what that means. The professor can address that when we come back. Somebody else texted in, apparently something with the military. The Spray Hawk is a rotary wing unmanned aerial vehicle. It carries a 30-foot spray boom with a capacity for 110 gallons of chemical. And I guess, again, drones can be anything to drop a missile on somebody from something that I got my kid to put his iPhone or her iPhone on. 9:20 more, we come back. Traffic now, WWL. No traffic, just a break, WWL. An interesting conversation with an interesting guy, Will Austin, Warren Community College president and the college's chief drone pilot. It is in the Washington, Warren Community College is in Washington Township, New Jersey, where they have had all of these drone sightings. If you're just joining us, if you have any questions about these drone sightings, 504-260-1870, that's the Oakenhart Jeweler talk and text line. And I'll pass them along. There is nothing nefarious going on here. Professor, if another country were to try to send drones in, or if another country were to try to send any kind of aircraft in, could the government detect it for those that believe that that's what's going on?
Yeah, they would already be detected. So if there was indeed something like an Iranian mothership, there are exercises of the Coast Guard currently going off the coast of New Jersey, so that would not be there. And in fact, if it was, it would already be at the bottom of the ocean. But I don't. There's no evidence that even such a thing exists. So, you know, our military. We've had people at the. Some of our faculty are military contractors over the years. A lot of them had to leave us to go handle things and assist people in other parts of the world that became hotspots. But one of them was back last week from Jordan, because we're doing a lot of things to build defenses over there in the Middle East. And he was mind boggled by it all, because he's what he was saying was, people in the United States don't know what it looks like when someone sends drones in that way, like I was just dealing with it over in Jordan. And this isn't an uncommon. A lot of the guys who worked for me before built the counter UAS systems in Kabul in Afghanistan. And it started really hard. What they used to have to do was satellite pictures of what the drone looked like on the outside. And then by just looking at those pictures, trying to figure out what antennas they had, they would rebuild the exact things our adversaries were building. And then they would fly them in and build the defense mechanism. So we have the capability. If there were foreign drones in the sky, the U.S. Air Force would already have dealt with that. We have a lot of practice from our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with drones of this nature. So we invented the Predator drone in a lot of ways. So we, at that same time, there are people in the military who every day, this is what they work on. I met one group of young men one time. All they do is work on antennas and radio frequency. So that's all they do, is master that. And it's kind of interesting to be around them, because, you know, to me, that's a very dry subject, but these guys can talk about antennas for hours. So we have real experts in the military. But here is a good point that I think the politicians have made. Militarily, we're really, really advanced. Mm-hmm. But civilly, there are local police and law enforcement. We really do have to get them trained well to use counter UAS equipment. You can still do something with a 2-pound drone. You could crash it into a car. You could do anything. But I want to remind people, you could do something with a plane as well, or a car. So any kind of machine can be turned into something nefarious. So the question is, we have means on the ground. We need means in the air to protect ourselves as this technology takes off, because it is going to be amazing what it does for us if we use it in good ways. We're going to find people who are missing. We'll be able to find people who've been murdered and buried, so their families. We have underwater drones. We're finding people around the country that have been lost for generations. We can deliver medical equipment. We can, you know, we do agriculture. You talked about that large spray drone, 100 pounds. We have 100 meters. We have one that's 50 liters, so half that size. So there are large drones flying in the national airspace. When we fly something that large, we have to file a flight plan with the FAA, and that person who flies a drone over 55 pounds has to not only have their Part 107, so that's the certificate for flying the small drones, but they also have to have the same certification that would be needed to fly an airplane up there. So there's a lot of regulation, but what there isn't is a lot of good communication about the robotic revolution, what's coming, and the regulations that the FAA already set up to make sure that the things we worry about are limited and unlikely to happen.
And as you say that, I'm certainly not encouraging this, and I hate to even mention it, but when you talk about crashing a 2-pound drone into a car, people have gone to jail already for dropping bricks and bowling balls off of overpasses and hurting people, so it doesn't have to be high tech at all. Let me get to a couple of questions, because I want the audience to text in, and I want to take advantage of your expertise. That being said, I want you to come back on and talk more about this, where we can spend another hour, because it fascinates me, the technology here. We could go for 8 hours with this, but we don't have the time today. What do you say of drones that go in and out of water that the Navy can't identify that are too fast? Does that exist, or is that something on the internet? Tell me about that.
Yeah, not really. So there have been attempts at this. So there are prototypes. I know Rutgers University is famous for kind of trying to build a drone that went underwater and came out in the air. The problem with the reason they don't really exist in the way that's described is water and electronics don't go well together. So you have to build the structure in such a way that it can go underwater without any of the electronic equipment being damaged. And it also has to fly in the airspace. So the engineering design on that is very difficult. The other thing that people forget when they describe such things, and why I'm pretty confident that didn't happen, is radio frequencies propagate through space. They propagate through our atmosphere, and we use those for the GPS signals, the control. But you cannot propagate a radio signal through water. That's why, if you remember, you ever seen anything with a submarine, they use sonar because they can't use radio frequencies under there. So if you were to put your drone underwater, you no longer have control of it. And what can happen then is, how do you get it back out? Now, you could program it to go in and then come out, but here's kind of what the underwater drones happen. When you have large underwater drones, they sink them under the water. They have a pre-programmed mission underwater, and they pop back up, and then you get the radio frequency to find out where they were. There's an old joke in that area, because when these things first came out, they cost a couple $1 million when they were first being designed. And the thing was, the successful mission for an underwater drone is you got the drone back. And one of the best places that was actually done was down near you in the Biloxi, Mississippi area. University of Mississippi created some really fantastic underwater drones for after the BP oil spill to kind of have that done. So we know enough about underwater drones that people have stopped trying to design these things that can go in air, land, and underwater. We built one here. It's probably the least threatening thing we have, because it's always breaking down because, again, you're taking electronics underwater and there's always leakage and everything else.
So somebody else texted in, and, Professor, just so you know, I did an hour one time on, and I had to fight Jordan Fiegel, our producer, to do it, but on fallacies of logic, just to kind of help people clear up how they think, right? And this is not your wheelhouse necessarily, but somebody texted in and said, we don't know what they are, but they're not nefarious, makes sense to me, which is kind of like proving a negative or starting with facts that are not in evidence. Are there drones? I mean, is there a big mystery here? Are people manufacturing a mystery, is what I'm saying?
Yeah, no problem. So, I'm a college president, which means I have 2 degrees in aviation, 2 degrees in sociology, a degree in leadership, and a degree in philosophy. So I'm happy to talk about logic.
So there you go. You're right there with me, right?
Yeah, a lot of this, I feel like when I'm talking to you, you're being very reasonable, which is awesome, because you're educating your audience. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people I'm talking to, I feel like I should speak to them like Mr. Spock on Star Trek and just say that's completely illogical. Because a lot of the things that are coming up and what people are describing are impossible aerodynamically. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just cannot do these things. The other thing is, this began on November 19th. It's a month later. Why would anyone nefarious fly around for a month drawing attention to themselves? And why would the person put lights on their drone so other aircraft wouldn't hit it if they were bad actors with a bad intention? I can put up a drone without turning the lights on tonight. You won't see it at all. I have fixed-wing drones that I could paint black and throw into the night sky, take the lights off, and you wouldn't see it. The reason we put lights on that can be seen for 3 statute miles isn't so we can admire them from the ground. It's so the other aircraft in the sky can avoid them.
Two questions. First of all, when they send these drones out that send a missile strike and take out a terrorist leader here, there, the other way, how big are those drones? They got to support the missile, right, and carry the missile?
Yes. So they're big enough. So they look like planes. You can kind of Google a Predator drone or a Reaper drone. They were originally surveillance drones. And then, of course, someone thought, well, if we weaponize this, it would be a good thing. Mm-hmm. They are flying at such an altitude. They're meant to be covert. So you're not going to fly. Let's say we're using one of these drones over in Afghanistan. We didn't fly them at 400 feet with the lights on, announcing we're coming so you could hear it. We were at a very high altitude, so it wasn't able to be seen, and it would hit its target from up there. So, it's kind of like when they say the military drone. Well, the last person to have legally flown a military drone over the state of New Jersey actually works for me now, and he was on the crew that did that. Military drones have been flying around for testing. We use the surveillance version of such drones down by the border for border patrol. So this stuff is in use. It's been in use for years. But I think what we've seen now is what I kind of anticipated would come. We've gotten to the point where there's over a million of them, the small recreational ones. People are doing the right thing. They're putting their lights on the drones. They're registering the drones. And it's kind of an irony because people are getting fearful over the people who are doing what they're supposed to be doing to protect the airspace and to make sure that they can fly safely and professionally in the sky. The other thing I would say is night operations are very difficult. So if you do get a drone, you want to remind everyone, fly it around in the day for a long time and get used to the controls, because it is extraordinarily difficult to fly at night. So if we have a class of 20 students here, and we fly during the day, the instructor will take out a lab assistant to help them with the students. When the night class for the same exact 20 students come, we take 5 instructors and 3 lab assistants out, because that is how much more difficult it is to master flying at night. So my biggest fear now isn't necessarily someone intentionally doing something wrong. It's the fact that they got a drone. There's a lot of things. The media attention to the night, and they're going to go out and fly it at night, and they've never done that before. There's an optical effect called the parallax effect in aviation, and this explains why planes. If you go outside tonight, you can convince your mind you see a drone by doing this. Most of the time, we walk outside and we glance up at the sky and see a plane, and then we walk maybe to our car, and then we glance again, and the plane has moved. If you stand perfectly still and you concentrate your eyes on a moving jet as hard as you can, the parallax effect will come into play, and it'll start to look like it's hovering. And that's just an optical illusion of our eyes. And people tell me, well, you know, you can see as well at night as day. We can't. And we know this from another logical conclusion. Our horror movies and our scary movies are always done at night. Rip Van Winkle was taken out at night because that's when we start to see shadows. If you've ever walked in a dark area, sometimes maybe you see something, you thought it was a person, and you realize it was just some trick your eyes played on you. The same thing is happening with this deep concentration on our night sky in New Jersey.
Professor, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this conversation. Real quick, and we do have to go. We only have 30 seconds. I asked you about the big drones. What's the smallest drone with a camera that you can fly?
Oh, I have one that weighs less than 0.55 pounds. So
really?
About a half a pound. Yeah.
No kidding. You got to come back. Is there a site that people can go to find out about regulations when it comes to drones, if they're thinking about gifting one to somebody and to guide them?
Definitely Google FAA trust certificate. The word trust, you need to pass a little test to fly in the national airspace if you're just flying for fun. So you want to get that certificate. You also want to go to the FAA drone zone and remember to register your drone. There were huge fines before for not doing these things. I wouldn't even want to be the first person to get caught now.
There are so many more things to talk about. We'll talk to you again after the first of the year. And also these displays where they do it with the drones, where it makes it look like fireworks, is amazing. Professor Will Austin, Warren Community College President, college's chief drone pilot. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays. Appreciate your time and your expertise, sir.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very much.
It's nice to talk to somebody reasonable. 942, 18 till 10, traffic now, WWL. Till 10, it's the holiday season, time for giving. Nothing will make you feel better about yourself, really, than doing something for somebody else. And I can think of no better cause than what we're doing. Well, I can think of a lot of good causes. One of them is what we're going to talk about here, being a CASA volunteer for Jefferson Parish. There are currently 40-plus children that need somebody to be a voice for them. And with that, we're joined by our friend Margaret Ether, advocate recruiter for CASA Jefferson. Good morning, Margaret. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. How are you?
Good morning. Happy holidays to you and all of your listeners. I'm great, and I pray everybody is great as well.
Yes, just ma'am. Right there with you. Go ahead. Just tell me about the program.
CASAs are court-appointed special advocates for children in foster care. We need volunteers really, really bad. As he said earlier, we have 40-plus children on the waiting list. You don't put children in your car. You don't bring them to your house. You don't take care of them. You're the eyes, ears, and voice for a child that's been taken from their parents due to abuse and neglect and are now in foster care. I know everybody's ready for the holidays, but I just wanted to lay something on your heart, mind, body, and soul for the new year, because somebody made a difference in your life. So step to the plate. Make a difference in one of our children's lives. These are our children, and we watch the news and we see everything, but make a difference so a child can learn that what happened at home wasn't their fault and that you are going to stand by them and be there to help them in their time of need and show them some direction. As I said, somebody made a difference in your life. So we need to look at our purpose in life. What are we going to do? Who are we going to help? How can we help? That's why I'm the advocate recruiter for CASA and wanting to see how many people are going to step up to the plate to be in our January class or in our March class to make a difference in our children's lives.
So if I decide to volunteer, Margaret, what am I going to be doing? What kind of commitment is it, et cetera?
Okay, you have to be 21 years or older. The commitment is a 5-chapter class. We do a complete background check. We have to make sure that all of the persons that want to help our children don't put them back into arm's way. The 5-chapter class starts in January. There's a special day to do court observation where you go to court and you sit down and you learn and watch what goes on in the proceedings. This is a different journey in your life. It helps you to understand the legal things that happen to children. Also, you're sworn in by the judge, and you're assigned to an advocate coordinator. The myth is we throw you out there, and you don't know what's going on. You're trained. You're assigned to somebody that coaches you, that goes with you on home visits, that help you to help our children. So we provide everything that's needed so you can be a good advocate and say, you know what, I did help somebody.
Is there any kind of I don't know, on the website or whatever, testimonies from people that have done this and shared their experience and what kind of difference it made both for them and their advocate or their advocate?
Yes.
Would that be the word?
Yes. If you go to the website, we just did our Christmas celebration with our children. There are advocates that have testified as to how they enjoyed and still do the work that help our children. There's a lot of resources there about CASA Jefferson. We do things a little bit differently. We have a toy room with toys that's been donated for our children. We make sure that all of what our children need and our advocate needs, we provide for that. As I said earlier, you don't use your money. We have resources that make a full difference in helping our children. We just need your time, which is 1 or 2 phone calls a week, 1 or maybe 2 home visits per month to make sure that all of their child's basic needs are being met. So you help out in a large capacity. It may seem like it's not enough time, but it's enough for a child to see that somebody does care.
And in terms of determining whether it's right for you or not, you can figure that out just by going through the process, right? And if it's not right for you, it's fair to everybody to let you know, let everybody know, before you make the commitment. But once you make the commitment, you got to be in.
Well, you don't want to commit to something that you're not sure about. So you sit down with an interview with me and we talk. before we sign the necessary paperwork, because there are some documents that have to be signed. As I said, we do a complete background check to make sure that everybody who says they want to do this, that they're really right. And we talk about what's expected. So it's not for everybody. I know that. I know it's not for everybody. But the persons that have a love for children and want to make a difference, it's for you. It doesn't interfere with your job. I'm always asked, well, how can I do this in my job? It's doable. I have people that still have full-time jobs. I have a guy that's a notary that's been doing this for almost 15 years. He's still doing it. People find, if you want to do this, there are ways to make it happen.
Margaret, I can't appreciate you enough and the work you do enough. And you know, you got a voice here whenever you need it, because I learned about CASA for the first time about 20 years ago, and it is extremely important. Margaret Ether, advocate recruiter for CASA Jefferson. There is a discernment process for both yourself and them to see if it fit. But if you're looking to make a difference in the new year, go to CASAJefferson.org, CASAJefferson.org. And see if it's right for you. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got when we come back, rather, on WWL.